Call the House Judiciary Committee to order February 11th, 1 o'clock. Staff, the first bill we've got up is 2312. You want to tell us about the...
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, Senate Bill 2312 comes to you from Representative Tom
Senate Bill. We've
it provides
that
charitable corporation is not liable for damages arising out of providing eyeglasses, hearing aid, or other medical devices without charge. Chair members of the committee, you should have the dash one amendments. If you don't, I have extra copies.
Okay.
I know a lot of stuff is being done electronically now, too, so if you don't have it, I have extra copies. And that basically limits it to used eyeglasses without charge.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues and chairs, I requested this bill at the request of the Lions Club members in my district, many of whom are here today. The Lions Foundation is a charitable organization that helps thousands of low-income individuals every year improve the quality of their lives with a special emphasis on sight and hearing. Members have been collecting used eyeglasses since 1951, and they distribute them to people in need. Over 100,000 pairs of glasses are collected by the Lion Club members every year in Oregon. Unfortunately, no Oregonians benefit from this program. I want you to hear that. No Oregonians can benefit from this program. All of the glasses collected here are shipped to other countries because the foundation has no legal protection in our state. They can be subject to lawsuits should something go amiss. Arizona and Alaska have passed legislation that provides immunity from liability, and now those states are successfully distributing glasses to their citizens, and we need to be able to do this also. House Bill 2312 is a simple bill that seeks to extend liability protection to the Lions Foundation so they can distribute these eyeglasses to our own residents here in Oregon. I understand there are discussions proceeding about the actual phrasing of the bill, and you have seen an amendment, and I think there might be another amendment, and these are in progress to tighten the language. Those amendments will be ready soon in time for a scheduled work session. Thank you again for hearing this bill. Its passage will help thousands of low-income Oregonians receive the vision that they need. I urge you to move this measure forward. And we have Lions members who here today to give you more details about their program and to answer any of your questions. And, of course, I will answer any questions that I'm able to answer.
Any questions? You know, you should have poked a couple of chairs here. We might have had a work session today.
Oh. I'll know next time. Thank you.
All right. I'll have you come up. There's only three mics there, so let's get... I'll do Tracy... is there Ullman? Ullman first, alone, and then I'll have some others come up. State your name, please, and then you can go right ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tracy Ullman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. I'm here today to speak on the safety precautions necessary for the dispensing of prescription eyewear. I have spent time over the last week talking to our eye doctors around the state and also with the Lions Foundation. And I believe that we have some concerns related to HB 2312. In its current state, it does not contain some of the necessary safeguards, although I know that you have some amendments in front of you. The Oregon Optometric Physicians Association feels strongly that the bill contained language that ensures patient safety by having an eye doctor involved in the dispensing, requiring a valid prescription, and adherence to national prescription standards. Although these eyeglasses may be appropriate for adult patients, children under the age of 14 are at a greater risk and should always have and receive a new, safe, appropriate pair of eyewear. Fortunately, we have programs currently to help all of those kids, so it's not an issue for them. But with more and more individuals uninsured, and with a lot of the vision cuts in Medicaid, It is our adult uninsured citizens that are in need of assistance, and this bill will help them out. In talking with the Lions Foundation, I think we have discussed some very appropriate language that would enable charitable organizations to provide a helping hand to those in need without hampering their safety and not putting them at risk. Thank you very much.
Committee member, do you have any questions?
I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's have Glenn Gilbert. I believe. Boy, somebody, Thomas. Is it Doris or Dave? I can't read the first name. Thomas. And then Dave Rich. Please. Go ahead and give us your name and start in any order you want.
My name is Glenn Gilbert. Mr. Co-Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm the Executive Director of the nonprofit Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation. It's truly an honor to take part in this democratic process today and testify today. As we hear the news from Cairo this morning that President Mubarak has resigned and democracy may result in Egypt, we take this process for granted. I was telling my kids this morning they should come down and be part of this with me, but today was pajama day at their school, and so that took precedent. I'm here today in enthusiastic support of House Bill 2312, and I urge you to support House Bill 2312 for a number of reasons, but since time is short, I'm going to do my best David Letterman impersonation and present to you the top 10 reasons why you should support HB 2312. Number 10, sitting behind me is a small sample of the support that 2312 has from 4,800 Lions Club members and Oregonians around the state, and I'd like to just ask the Lions to and staff to stand for just one moment and be recognized for all the incredible work that you do.
Great.
Thank you. Number 9, there are currently 643,000 Oregonians that lack health insurance and thousands more that do not have vision coverage. And as you know, health insurance is terrific, but vision coverage takes care of glasses. So many more people don't have that coverage. Number 8, the need for eyeglasses in Oregon was magnified when the Oregon Health Plan dropped vision coverage and glasses for adults in January of 2010. Number 7, for over 50 years, Lions Club members in Oregon have collected used eyeglasses and distributed them all over the world. But as you heard sponsor Representative Tomei say, never in Oregon. Approximately 75,000 pairs of glasses are given away by Lions to impoverished people each year just from the state of Oregon collecting them, and primarily those go to Mexico. Number 6, Lions Clubs in Oregon spend an estimated $200,000 already on new eyeglasses each year to help Oregonians in need. Yet nearly all 175 Lions Clubs in the state turn people down as well due to lack of funds. If HB 2312 is passed, Lions Clubs will continue to distribute new glasses, but this will help us help people who are living at or below 150% of the federal poverty level to ensure that those truly in need benefit from HB 2312. And as you heard, two other states, Alaska and Arizona, have passed very similar legislation. We called our colleagues who do exactly what we do here in Oregon in Alaska and Arizona, and there has been no litigation or health issues that have arisen as a result of the thousands of people that have received used eyeglasses in those two states in the past 8 years. Oregon should be the next state to pass legislation like this. Number 3, dispensing used eyeglasses would require an eligible Oregonian possess a prescription for eyeglasses and that those glasses be dispensed by a licensed eye care professional. And we trust that those people know how to do their job. Number 2, if HB 2312 already has the endorsement of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmologists, the MDs, and the Northwest Health Foundation, patient health and safety is a top priority for us. We trust that licensed vision professionals will dispense used eyeglasses only if a good match is found. Otherwise, we will try to obtain new glasses for each person we can. That's why we're working closely with the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, represented by Tracy Ullman today. And number 1, this is where the drum roll usually comes in. Finally, number 1 reason to support HB 2312 is your support of this bill will help Oregonians like a woman named Ariella, who lives in Northeast Portland, will help her find work. She's living on food stamps. This is a real person, by the way, and raising a disabled son. She cannot afford eyeglasses and cannot drive without them. HB 2312 may help provide her the gift of sight, but it'll also provide her the gift of dignity and hopefully work. Thank you for hearing this bill, and we'd greatly appreciate your support.
Yes, I just wanted to to say thank you. The Troutdale Lions Club has been a big part of the city of Troutdale for many decades. We've had mayors that were Lions, and as a matter of fact, one of my predecessors, Glenn Otto, my understanding was a Lion. And so thank you very much to your fine organization for being a big part of the Troutdale community.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gilbert, thank you for all that you and your wonderful members do. I have personally donated used glasses when they are longer effective for me, and I appreciate having someplace to do that. I want to make sure I understand the bill, and I believe, and certainly your testimony has suggested, that you bring it forward in a charitable and altruistic way, but there are some things that I just need to understand. You referenced Alaska and Arizona and the report back that there has been no incidents of litigation or any problems or anything, so I'm not sure whether we are proposing a solution that's looking for a problem. If they're not experiencing litigation, what problem is this bill fixing?
Well, I'll give you just one example. When Hurricane Katrina struck several years ago, Lions came in to try to distribute used eyeglasses to people who had not only lost their eyeglasses but lost their homes and their lives, and were told they couldn't do it. And so that's the problem we're trying to solve, which is primarily one of fear. We live in a society that's very litigious. Lions have been doing this for 50 years, but they haven't been doing it in Oregon primarily because they believe they will get in trouble if they do. And so, sure, we could do it now without this bill, but we'd be much more likely to do it with the protection of this bill. And that's exactly what's happened, by the way. The only two states in the country that are doing it are Arizona and Alaska.
Who said that the Lions couldn't do this in New Orleans?
I'm not sure. I think it was
the state of Louisiana.
Local officials who actually stopped them, and then when they went back to the headquarters, LCI International, which is in Illinois, the headquarters said, "Don't do it." And I can tell you, actually, what's happened here is almost the rumor that it's against the law has resulted. When I started this job 2 years ago, I was told that we can't do it; that it's simply against the law.
Well, that one we should certainly
fix because it's not against the law here. If I might follow up, Mr. Co-Chair, as I read both the bill as submitted and the proposed amendment which replaces the entire bill, both of them provide blanket exemptions or shields for not just Lions but other organizations that provide this service. While it makes some sense to me, and I can understand the testimony you've provided that justifies it, that
you should be protected if
there are errors of omission resulting from something that was benign. But the way I read this language, it would also shield any organization even if they took an affirmative action that caused the damage.
Right.
Am I reading that right?
Let me just say thank you for pointing out that this isn't just exclusively a bill for the Lions. This would
That's
allow
right.
other nonprofits to possibly do this. We felt that would be only fair. Just to point out as well, though, that we collect 75,000 glasses. It's a little bit like being the iPod and somebody else is trying to become your competitor in this market. So we think it's very unlikely that anybody else will actually do it. But to really answer your question, I think I would answer it by just telling you that the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association didn't have a problem with the way the bill was written and supported. So that's the starting point. We knew that going in here that if the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association didn't like it, we might have a problem, and that's not the case. However, if this is what it would take to pass this into law, a phrase that exempted gross negligence or intentional misconduct would be totally fine with us. And I think that's what Alaska actually did. Arizona's is incredibly simple and closer to what we have, but Alaska's, I believe, does have a gross negligence statement, which, by all means, if that's what it takes to win your support, I think we wouldn't have a problem adding that to this bill.
I'll just follow up briefly again, Mr. Chair, and then I'll be finished. Given that it is not just for the Lions that has a good track record and experience doing this, but it is for all of those Brand X competitors you referenced, I think we certainly should not give immunity to organizations where there is gross negligence that I don't expect would happen with your organization, but we should protect. This also includes hearing aids and other medical devices, which other medical devices is a pretty broad term. Pacemaker is a medical device. Some other very sophisticated equipment would be considered a medical device.
Right.
I get pretty nervous about why you would include things that could, in fact, require very sophisticated professionals to be giving them and teaching the patient on how to use them. Why did you expand it beyond eyeglasses?
Well, let me first say we were a little surprised when Legislative Council put that in. But when they did, we realized that it could help us because we do give out occasionally a CCTV, which is one of those magnifiers that allows a nearly blind person to read. And we do other devices. We thought that maybe instead of pulling it out completely, we could make it vision and hearing related. We're not going to give out crutches. We don't do that. But I understand your point. And again, it wasn't our intent in the first place. It's primarily focused on glasses and hearing aids.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you
for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank the Lion Club for their service to the community and for helping support this Representative Tomei's bill. I had the pleasure of speaking to Mr. Gilbert today, and one of the Lions Club members sitting in the audience, former State Representative Tom Bosetnet. And Tom, we didn't have the pleasure of introducing him on the chamber this morning because we're not in session, but thank Tom for his continued service to the community. We also talked to them about their work on a bill that we passed last February that we'll be hearing from the Lions Club on as a pilot project with $150,000 to look at nonprofits doing visual screening in our schools. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the time.
Thank you. Anything further, committee? Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm David Rich, and I'm Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing us today. I'm a member of the Beaverton Lions Club. I'm here to support House Bill 2312. For nearly 50 years, the Lions Clubs of Oregon have been collecting used eyeglasses and distributing them out of the country to adults and children who cannot afford them. As Glenn said, we have collected 100,000 pair of glasses approximately each year and distribute 60,000 to 75,000 of these, mainly in Mexico and Africa. I personally have participated in trips to Mexico with groups of Lions to distribute used eyeglasses to those in need. And tell you what, they are really, really appreciated when you can't afford something and you are given the ability to see. It is amazing. Because of liability concerns, as Glenn said, Lions Clubs in Oregon could but do not distribute eyeglasses domestically. Those concerns were once again heightened as I'm repeating Glenn on a couple of these things, but Hurricane Katrina was an opportunity for us to distribute eyeglasses. The Lions and Clubs International basically instructed us not to do so because of liability concerns. Lions are proud of a motto we serve, and we are most proud of what we have done to meet the challenge of Helen Keller, who over 80 years ago asked the Lions to be the Knights of the Blind in a crusade against darkness to stop preventable blindness. Our 45,000 Lion Clubs and 1.35 million members make us the largest service club in the world. We're also one of the most effective because we get things done. Lions hosts 17 recycling centers around the world, and 11 of them are in the United States. One of them happens to reside here in Oregon. That provides a unique opportunity with the passage of House Bill 2312 to use a small percentage of those 100,000 pairs of eyeglasses collected each year to change the lives of Portland, or change the lives of people right here in Oregon. Too many Oregonians can't see properly because they can't afford to buy glasses and are pushed deeper into poverty simply because of that fact. They can't learn because reading is difficult. They can't find jobs or work to do the best of their ability because they can't see clearly. As Glenn pointed out earlier, the Lions here today represent 4,800 Lions throughout Oregon, from Brookings to Baker City, and from Grants Pass to Gresham. So we're asking that you approve House Bill 2312 so that the Lions Club in Oregon will feel comfortable working with eye care professionals to supply eyeglasses to Oregonians who need but can't afford them. Thank you for hearing this bill. Lions and those less fortunate than we are throughout the state of Oregon will appreciate your support. Thank you.
Committee members, any further questions? Looks like not. Thank you, gentlemen.
Is there a third one?
We did. Excuse me?
We have one.
Got one more?
Yeah.
We do. Go ahead.
Mr. Co-Chairman and committee members, my name is Doug Thompson, and I'm from right here in Salem, and I'm the Resource Development Director of the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation, and I'm here today to read a testimony from Dr. Richard Chenoweth, which you have included in your packet. To whom it may concern, my name is Dr. Richard Chenoweth. I am a retired ophthalmologist from Ashland, Oregon. I am sorry I could not be with you today, but I am writing in support of House Bill 2312. I obtained my medical degree in 1963 at the University of Illinois College of Medicine in Chicago. I was an active duty U.S. Army doc from 1963 to 1971 during the Vietnam War. I was chief at the Department of Ophthalmology at Walter Reed General Hospital and moved to Portland in 1972 to become the first full-time director of the Devers Eye Clinic and chief of the Department of Ophthalmology at Good Samaritan Hospital. I held those positions until 1990. My primary subspecialty was as a retina surgeon. I was also an assistant professor of ophthalmology at OHSU. I also trained 32 retina surgeons and established or ran four other training programs for medical personnel. I also helped start the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon in 1975. The Devers Eye Clinic has become one of the largest indigent eye care clinics in the U.S. As chief, I saw thousands of indigent patients over the years. That is why I am writing in support of House Bill 2312. Lions do an amazing job providing new glasses to Oregonians, but there is never enough money to help everyone living at or near poverty. We collect tens of thousands of glasses, but none are used to help Oregonians. As an eye surgeon, I know that many of these glasses could be distributed here in Oregon with the proper health and safety precautions that are being put into this bill. Please do not let special interests water down this legislation until it is impossible to match glasses to an indigent person. I hope you will support House Bill 2312. Thank you, Dr. Richard G. Chenoweth, Ashland, Oregon.
Further committee questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if I got this right, but is it Ken Simila? Simila?
Simila.
Simila. Close.
My name is Ken Simila. I'm a Lion in the Salem Downtown Lions Club. I live here in Salem. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2312 for many of the same reasons you have just heard. I'm retired now. I'm a mechanical engineer by background, but my full-time activity now is volunteering with Lions, with the Mount Hood Ski Patrol, with Northwest Medical Teams, now Medical Teams International, and other organizations. And I'd just like to share with you what this bill could mean to people in Oregon, as have been described, who are at or near the poverty level. Some of our club members, incidentally, have made trips to San Blas, Mexico, and some of the other locations where our Oregon Lions have collected eyeglasses, and they have been distributed. Many of you wear corrective lenses. You may have children and grandchildren that wear corrective lenses. And for those who have not known from their infancy on that they have bad eyesight, it's a real eye-opener, literally, when you discover that. Many of you may have had a similar experience. When I was in grade school here in Salem, exams and screening was not done on a regular basis. And I remember going into the classroom in my grade school and not being able to see what the teacher was writing on the chalkboard. So I would break the lead in my pencil and walk up to the front where the pencil sharpener was so I could see what was on the board. Then I would go back and do what I was supposed to do till I couldn't see the next problem, break the lead on the pencil, and walk up and be able to see what the teacher had written. She finally figured out why I was doing it. Well, it was amazing to me when I got my first pair of corrective lenses shortly after that, looking out the second floor bedroom window and I home, those white specks in the yard were daisies. I didn't know our yard had daisies, but when I got my first corrective lenses, I could see daisies. There are many children and adults in Oregon who have not seen the daisies, so please do what you can to give us the ability to share those with Oregonians. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 2312 and open a public hearing on 2685. And Russ Lipinski?
Yeah, go ahead. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2685 comes to you from the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. Allows for termination of the attorney-client relationship after entry of judgment or other final determination if a notice of termination is filed.
Russ is a witness for Mexican balls and vegetables.
Still some neglected.
Yeah.
You can't see Stan.
Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Russ Lipinski. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. My practice is limited to family law issues. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. The first bill that I'm here to talk about is House Bill 2685. Currently, by statute, ORS 19.380, there are certain procedures that an attorney must go through to withdraw from representing a client in a case. Currently, under current statute, there are two specific scenarios mentioned. One is at any time during a case, and one is upon before final judgment is entered, and the other time is upon an order of the court. What this bill seeks to address is how an attorney is able to get off a case at the end of a case when the attorney has fulfilled all the duties for which the attorney has been hired without having to go through the process of filing a motion, supporting affidavit, and an order for a judge to sign saying that, yes, indeed, it's okay for the attorney to get off the case. Under this bill, that would only happen when the attorney has concluded all the services for which the attorney has been hired. It should save the court some money because the court will not have to administer the motions and the affidavits and the orders and get those signed. It'll save attorneys some time and consequently save their clients some money, and we can't see any downside to it. We think it's a common sense addition to the statute, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have about it.
Any members? Representative Warren?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we missed just one little addition in this particular statute. The requirement that the attorney providing notice state an address for their now former client. Because what happens is if we don't have that provision in the statute, they'll have to add it by local rule or by the Uniform Trial Court rules. But if you don't have that address, then the other lawyer or the other opposing party or even the court doesn't know where to send notices or things like that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Representative Wong. The requirement that an attorney in withdrawal documents include the last known address of their client is in rule. I confess I don't recall off the top of my head whether it's in the Uniform Trial Court rules or the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, but that requirement is there by rule. This statute is certainly not intended to supersede that requirement that is there by rule. I suppose it could be added to the statute. I frankly don't know that it's necessary because, as I said, I don't think the statute does away with that requirement. It's a sound requirement, but it would still exist under rule, as my understanding is.
Any further? I'll have you stay there, I think, for now. I'll close the public hearing on 2685 and open one on 2686.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2686 comes to you from the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. It repeals the 90-day waiting period for trial of hearing on merits and dissolution of marriage proceedings require parties seeking post-judgment temporary order for custody or parenting time to concurrently file a motion to permanently modify the judgment.
Committee, my name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. My practice is limited to family law. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill addresses three distinct issues. I'll cover them separately. Sections 1 and 2 address the current statutory waiting period of 90 days that exists before a final judgment can be taken on a judgment of dissolution of marriage without the court affirmatively waiving that 90-day waiting period. The statute, and it's ORS 107.065, was enacted in 1971 concurrent with the repeal of fault divorce. There was a concern when we went into a no-fault divorce in 1971 that there would be the proverbial flood of litigation that would come in. So concurrent with doing away with the fault aspects of dissolution of a marriage, this statute was passed that would slow that process down a little bit and created a statutory mandatory 90-day waiting period before you could have a final judgment entered. There's no judicial purpose or any other purpose that we can identify that is still served by that statute. And to the contrary, it creates problems. Parties that settle out of court, as most parties do, and if they want a judgment entered within that 90-day time frame, they have to affirmatively file a motion, supporting affidavit, an order with the court, getting the court to waive that 90-day time frame. We think that if parties settle their case, they shouldn't have to go through that extra step of getting that 90-day time frame waived. And consequently, what this bill does is it simply repeals the 90-day waiting period so that you no longer have that impediment. This will also save the courts some money. As you know, a tremendous number of self-represented litigants that go through the court systems, and the courts have a process, all of them, for these self-represented litigants, and that includes currently having to hold off on 90 days before they can process this paperwork because of this waiting period. So this should create some efficiencies for the court system, and we can identify no downside, and we're not aware of any opposition. I'm happy to answer questions.
Anybody have anything?
Okay. Section 3 of the bill, and this is the same bill, talks about awards of temporary custody in a domestic relations case. Currently, in a domestic relations case, the court always has authority to modify custody if there's a change of circumstances. And ORS Chapter 107.135 has the procedures and the substantive rules for engaging in a change of custody proceeding after a judgment has been entered. There is also a separate statute that provides the authority and the procedure for an award of temporary emergency changes of custody. If a child is in immediate danger and a showing is made of immediate danger, the court has the authority to enter an immediate ex parte, without notice or a hearing, temporary custody order. So we have those two statutes happening, existing side by side concurrently, and that's fine. The problem is that on occasion someone will engage in the immediate ex parte temporary custody procedure and get an immediate ex parte temporary custody order, but then not follow through with the more reasoned provisions of 107.135 that require notice and a hearing and an opportunity for the court at some point to decide what's in the best interest of the child. So what this bill does, it says if you're going to go into court and get an immediate temporary custody change, you need to concurrently or already have filed a regular, if you will, a non-emergency modification proceeding so that the court has a procedural context within which to at some point determine what's in the best interest of the child. That way someone can't get an immediate temporary order and then just sit on it indefinitely and act as if there's been a formal change of custody when in fact there hasn't been. There's only been an ex parte one. So that's what Section 3 of the bill does. Any questions about that aspect? Thank you.
Nope.
More. Section 4 of the bill deals with unmarried parents as opposed to married parents in child custody issues. Chapter 107 contains many provisions relating to different aspects of child custody, child support, parenting time, and issues like that. Chapter 109, specifically 109.103, is a statute that says for unmarried parents, certain specified provisions of Chapter 107 that relate to married parents are bootstrapped in. In other words, 109.103 allows unmarried parents to use all the procedures in Chapter 107 that apply to married parents when it comes to setting child support, parenting time, custody issues, and things like that. It bootstraps in for unmarried parents the things relating to children that we find in Chapter 107 dealing with married parents. The problem is that over the years, Chapter 107 has been amended from time to time, and various provisions have been added and amended and taken away, and Chapter 109.103 has not concurrently bootstrapped in those changes to Chapter 107. So what we have currently in 109.103 is a specified list of provisions in Chapter 107 that are brought into play for unmarried parents that is at this point incomplete because unintentionally it has over the years not been kept up to speed with the changes to Chapter 107. So what this bill does, we went through the family law section and looked at all the provisions of Chapter 107 that should be applied for unmarried parents under Chapter 109, and we've expanded 109.103 to bring all those provisions in so that they can be all dealt with for unmarried parents the same way as they are with married parents. That's what Section 4 of the bill does. Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, that concludes my comments, and again, I'm happy to answer questions.
Anybody have any questions? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 286.
Chair,
you got one?
Yes.
Chair Barker, representative, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I apologize for not signing up. Representative Wisnett indicated earlier that he had a question, so I wanted to respond to that, and so thank you for allowing me to do that. And Representative, I believe your question was related to grandparents.
Mr. Chair, yeah, we talked about whether I know we passed some rights for grandparents and kins in the past legislative sessions, and it doesn't mention that in this bill, and that was my question. Is it covered or is it separate statute?
And the answer is yes, there is a separate statute in Chapter 109.119 that addresses the rights of grandparents in visitation and custody proceedings and the ways in which orders can be modified and entered, and it's a different set of standards than between parents, because parents have biological rights to visitation of their children, and grandparents have a set of criteria they need to satisfy before they can get into court on those issues. So it's a different statute.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair, I was just trying to clarify that we didn't want to, because we did work hard on that previous legislation. It was. Thank you.
I hope that answers your question.
Now, is there anybody else that want to testify, or anybody out in the hall? Any questions? You're smiling, Representative Nolan. It's the first time.
You're not paying attention, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
I smile a lot.
Close public hearing then on 2686. And open a public hearing on 2687.
Chair, members of the committee, 2687 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar. Family law section requires a person ordered to pay temporary spousal support to pay the other party rather than the clerk of the court, the court administrator, or the Department of Justice. Allows the court to include the amount of temporary child support and spousal support requested after commencement of the suit in the general judgment. Chair, members of the committee, that's basically the bill.
Thank you. Co-Chairs Krieger Barker, members of the committee, my name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. My practice is limited to family law. I'm appearing today on behalf of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, the proponents of this particular bill. There are two parts to this bill. The first is primarily a housekeeping provision. The second is a bit more substantive. Currently, ORS 107.095 is a statute that states in a domestic relations case when there is an order for temporary spousal support or temporary what we call suit money or temporary attorney fees or a temporary payment of money for witnesses and things of that nature, the statute specifies that those payments are to be made to the Department of Justice, the court clerk, or the court administrator, whichever is appropriate. In fact, under current practice and procedure, none of those entities is appropriate to receive those payments. Courts always, when we have these types of temporary orders, it's in order for one party to pay those funds to the other party. Our court clerks are certainly not equipped to administer the payment of those funds. They're never paid to the court clerks. This statute dates to 1971, and it's simply time to clean it up and specify that those types of temporary court orders should have the money be paid from one party to the other party, not to the clerk of the court or the court administrator or the Department of Justice. This bill, I should clarify, does not preclude a party who's receiving temporary spousal support from applying for services from the Child Support Division for distribution and the services that they're authorized to provide under Chapter 25. This one is in no way intended to preempt that. It simply specifies that the payment is to be made in the first instance, or at least the order is to specify that payments to be paid from one party to another, and then a party who seeks to have collection services can certainly do so under Chapter 25. That's the first part of the bill. That's Section 1. Any questions about that? Okay. Co-chair is a member of the committee. Section 2 talks about what happens when there has been, in a domestic relations case, a motion for temporary support filed during the case. And by the time the case comes for a final hearing or a final judgment is entered, there's not been a hearing on that motion for temporary support. This most often comes up when a party needs temporary child support or temporary spousal support, files an appropriate motion for that support, but the parties either settle the case or the court sets the case for a final hearing before setting it for a separate hearing on the motion for temporary support. What this bill does is it gives the court the authority in a final judgment to include any amounts of temporary support that the court concludes could have been and should have been ordered under the temporary motion. It's contingent on a temporary motion having been filed and served. In other words, you can't, at the time of a final judgment, retroactively say, by the way, I'd like some back support for the past year from the time I filed my petition. The court can only go retroactive to the date that a motion for temporary support was filed and served, so we don't have a notice problem, and it gives the court the authority to wrap that amount into a final judgment without it having gone away simply because it was not ruled upon during the pendency of a case. We think this will create some efficiencies for the courts because people might not be as eager to come into court for a temporary support hearing if they know that in their final judgment they can have that issue dealt with and that the court will have the authority to go back for that period of time and order support that was accruing or that the court thinks should have been paid while the case was pending if a motion for temporary support was filed. There is an amendment, and it's in your material. After the LC draft came out, the Division of Child Support, as well as the proponents, the Family Law Section, as well as others, had concerns that the bill as originally drafted did not adequately reflect that this retroactive support award could only be for a period of time in which a motion had actually been filed and served for temporary support. And so we worked with the Division of Child Support and came up with amendments that have not gone to Legislative Council yet, but I'm providing them to you. And I also have included in my written material a letter from Jean Fogarty, the Child Support Program Director, in which she expresses agreement with the amendment that is in my written material. So we would ask that that amendment be made. We think it's an important part of the bill. We apologize that it wasn't picked up on and addressed sooner, but it is important, and everyone, as far as we know, is in agreement with it. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions about that.
No one else is going to testify and jump up and run up here? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Friday afternoon, 26:87. Yeah, anyone that does is going to drive me the next 6 hours to Gold Beach.
That's an invitation that's hard to turn down, Mr. Chair.
Get me out of town, huh? Okay, we'll open a public hearing on 2689.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2689 comes to you from the Oregon from the Oregon Law Commission. Chair, members of the committee, the bill basically allows language to the summons for appearance in juvenile court proceedings that if you are a party to the proceeding, you have the right to appeal a judgment to the Court of Appeals, but must do so no later than 30 days after entry of judgment.
Here she comes, Wendy Johnson.
Chair, Co-Chair Barker, Wendy Johnson, Oregon Law Commission Deputy Director and General Counsel. Thanks for having me this afternoon, and I know I'm the last bill between you and the weekend, so I'll be brief. This is probably the Law Commission's easiest bill of the session, so it is appropriate that it's the first bill before you. For some of the members of the committee, you haven't heard about the Law Commission yet, and so I'll just briefly explain what the Law Commission is. The Law Commission was created in 1997 to provide a continuous program of law reform for the state. So the legislature basically created the commission to assist the legislature with law reform, recognizing that fewer and fewer lawyers are in the legislature, more and more time is being spent on the budget, and less time on just substantive law reform, especially nonpartisan reform, to make our statutes work better for litigants, the public, and the bench. And so the Law Commission tackles a whole variety of issues across many different areas of law, and juvenile law, though, has been a common piece of our work since 1997. But the Law Commission is a 15-member commission, and on the testimony that I provided to you today, on the written testimony, you'll see on the letterhead the list of our commissioners. 15 commissioners from each branch of government, the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. The two legislative members appointed by your House Speaker are Representative Chris Garrett and Lane Shetterly are the House members. Former Representative Lane, but he was appointed by the Speaker. The statute permits appointment of former legislators as well as present members, and in fact, up until recently, neither requirement was for the legislative appointments. It could be anyone actually, but that was tightened up in a recent session. So Lane does serve as at the pleasure of the Speaker presently. So that's just kind of who our commission is. All of those folks, as you can tell, are very busy in other areas of the law and volunteer their time to serve on the commission. We're housed over at Willamette University College of Law through a joint partnership with the state. The state budget is approximately half of the cost of what it costs to run the commission, and Willamette puts in the other half to house the commission and provide the staffing for the commission. And then we also are able to leverage all of our work group participants who volunteer as well. So that's kind of who we are and what we're made of. Two big examples. Some folks ask me if we have the big bill of the session, because two big examples are the judgments bill and the bond bills that passed in sessions past, where we rewrote the whole chapter of law that had been a mess for many years. And so we're going to have a huge bill this session to report that's going to be taking up a lot of paper, but probably our biggest project for this session is the inheritance tax rewrite of that chapter of 118. So we just have a couple juvenile bills that will wind their way into judiciary, and the first one is the one before you today, House Bill 2689. The juvenile group of the Law Commission is composed of defense attorneys, district attorneys, juvenile court judges, juvenile department representatives, family lawyers, juvenile lawyers. So it's basically the whole juvenile group of folks, both dependency and delinquency. And so those are the people that are on that work group, and they just continue to meet year after year and volunteer their time. And each year they come up with a few areas that still need to be improved, and the one before you today is on the summons form itself. The Oregon Revised Statute has a summons form that each county is supposed to use as its form. And what we have learned is that in many counties that form is used as a notice to the parents or the guardians of children who are in the dependency court. And so ORS 419B117 requires four different things to be on that notice that they receive at first appearance. And because some courts are using the summons, we decided to recommend putting in the missing parts into the summons, because that's the paper that's used. It hasn't become a huge issue, but we don't want the litigants to claim that they didn't get the right notice when they got a piece of paper. And so if we're going to use this form, we might as well add it. So the only thing that's being added to the summons form is notice requirements regarding your right to an appeal and when that appeal must be filed. So on the bill, it's page 3. It's the only bolded part, but it just provides that if your rights are affected, you have a right to an appeal, and that you also have a right to an attorney for that appeal, and that you have basically 30 days after the court's judgment to make that appeal. So it's not a substantive change in the law. It's just providing notice on the summons form. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair. Oh, this is really quick.
That's okay.
So all the counties are really excited about this in Wendy?
Representative Olson, I wouldn't say they're excited, but it just they're finally in compliance. It's kind of sliding under the radar. But it makes them in compliance if they use that form.
Anything further? Thank you, Wendy. And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2689. Mr. Taylor, we don't have anything else, do we?
Dear members of committee, you can start heading to Gold Beach very soon.
Then we'll close the committee for today. Thank you.